When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It is mind-blowing.
And heartbreaking.
How many original scripts are written every year but are never made?
So we seek out these scripts and bring them to life with full audio production and professional actors.
Check us out at Undiscovered Scripts.
Movies made of paper.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Free!
Joe, we are back at Newport Beach once again. This time, we are talking about episode 9 of season 3, The Disconnect. And
whatever Joe, could it mean?
What could it possibly mean? I want to jump to the moment where I was screaming at my television, which is later on in this episode. Now, I can't even figure out if it was annoyed scream or delighted by the absurdity scream, just that I did in fact scream. So part of this episode is that Ryan and Matt have to work on a proposal in like 24 hours for potential investors. Mm-hmm. And Matt's like, we're going to pull an all-nighter, boss. You can count on me. And then he takes Ryan to a strip club. And he immediately goes to the champagne room with this stripper and, like, pays for Ryan to get a lap dance. Right? It's wildly inappropriate in every possible way.
Yeah.
And then next day, it's time for the meeting with the investors. They are not, like, nearly as prepared or ready as they should be. Investors drop out, right?
Yeah.
Sandy shows up at strip club. He's rightfully pissed. He yells at Matt for kind of fucking this up and all the things that he did wrong. And you see a stripper watching Sandy Cohen leave. And then this stripper shows up and is like, Matt's a friend from school. I'm going to law school. And also, I was the one who connected him with the investors.
Yeah.
So I can fix all of these problems.
Yep.
And I was like, this is a bridge too far, Joe. This is officially, I could
is
buy.
Is this where the jumping of the shark happens?
Here's the thing. I could go along with the ride until the, like, I'm the one that connected him with the investors. And I was like, what is this show? Like, it's insane.
Matt, if I was in charge of naming this episode, and by this episode, I mean like this episode of our show of White People Problems, I would call it Stripper Ex Machina because, because, you know, stripper comes down. I feel bad. I feel a little, I have to say, maybe it's my like cis male privilege, but I do feel bad that we keep calling her stripper. We don't know her name.
Well, the show also didn't give us a character name. So unfortunately, she's just stripper.
She's maybe a stripper lawyer.
Stripper lawyer. Maybe she gets a name in a future episode.
She's
maybe she
stripper
joins
Esquire.
The firm. I don't know. Yeah, like it's ridiculous. But yeah, just like you said, like the hand of God, here she comes into the office to fix all of their problems.
Yeah. So like
the magical stripper, I believe, is what Spike Lee calls them.
So basically he's been like booking the champagne room to like talk the therapy to therapy with this girl, which, like, first of all, that's great that your friend wants to give you money, and then it's guaranteed that you are gonna have like a positive experience in the champagne room, right? Where it's there's no pressure.
Yeah, there's no sex in the champagne room. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that Chris Rock song, but
I've heard of it. I've never been to a strip club, so
I've never been there. Do you remember the Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen song?
Is that the one where it's like wear sunscreen?
Yeah, that Chris Rock did a parody of it called "There's No Sex in the Champagne Room." Where he's talking about all the rules in the champagne room. And my favorite line was like, now don't get me wrong, there's champagne in the champagne room. <He's> like, just no sex. That's the only thing I know about champagne rooms. Thank you, Chris Rock, for teaching me that important rule. The first half of that, like I said, the first half of it, as absurd as it is, I can still buy it. It's definitely the I connected him with those clients line where I'm just like, what is happening? Where is the like, this is so ridiculous. They're clients of mine. That's how we got them. We worked together. We exchanged numbers and portfolios and like, I don't know.
They slipped me a 20. I slipped them a prospectus. Like,
well, that's what I was going to say. Let's pretend you are a businessman who goes to this strip club with such frequency that you have a regular champagne room stripper that you utilize.
You have a regular stripper.
And
the dream.
And she says to you, oh, one of my other regulars does that type of work and would love for you to invest in their business. Are you going to take her up on that offer even one little bit, knowing that you're both just connected by having the same champagne room stripper connection? Like,
well, here, I watched Hustlers, right? Like,
yeah, I did too. I saw it in theaters.
And so you saw Hustlers in theaters?
Oh, of course I did. I had MoviePass back then. Oh God, I saw everything in theaters.
I watched Hustlers, and part of me wouldn't be surprised if, you know, lawyer stripper was like, you're going to meet with my friend, or your wife's going to know.
Yeah, that's true. You've been doing. True.
Like, that's where I thought that was going to go. But no, it's just very reputable, which is just like, this is the epitome of, like, Newport Beach, right? Like, even the strippers, you can take a corporate meeting, the strippers will get you connected.
Yeah, you're just having a meeting at the free brunch at the strip club on a Sunday morning or whatever. Like, but that's like a very small little subplot, honestly. Now let's talk about the most obnoxious subplot in this episode, which is Seth Cohen just leaning into being one of the absolute most pathetic characters in television history, having a conniption fit that his girlfriend might actually be smart. Maybe even a little bit smarter than him. But the way he's acting, that, like, this is the exact same thing that we were complaining about with Summer, where, like, Seth had this incredible experience where someone was interested in buying a comic book that he created, and she could not focus on anything more than, like, how does this affect my time with my boyfriend? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And now here he is just, like, trying to prove that she's, like, an anomaly. Like, he says something shitty, like, well, I heard somewhere that if they took a bunch of third graders and put them in a room, that one of them would ace the STTs or SATs by mistake.
The STDs.
Yeah, the STDs. The SATs by mistake. And she's just like, well, not a third grader, and then just walks away. Like, as much as Seth annoyed me in this episode, my love for Summer, like, quadrupled this episode. She
oh
is
my
so
God. No.
She's
hold on.
So laid back and chill this whole time as she's, like, crushing it in the SATs and could not care less about it.
Here's the thing, Matt. You believe that Stripper Ex Machina is the most incredulous part of this episode. I believe that Summer is a genius is the most, like, incredulous part of this episode, because it just comes out of, again, it comes out of nowhere, right? Like, we all know that Summer has, like, and it comes out in this episode that Summer has, like, the kind of emotional and social intelligence that Seth doesn't. But mm-hmm. the fact that now we add it, so she's actually the full package?
Yeah, that is, okay.
Like, that's get out of here with that. And I don't mind that because, like, I don't mind that as much as I mind, like, I'm less annoyed by that than I am about Seth's response, which is, like, typical, fragile, masculine. Like, this is the reason why in rewatches of the show, and this is how you know that, like, I know that I've grown, is that Seth's response to this is really poor.
Oh, terrible.
It's really, really poor. Because it's no matter how you slice it, if you're not going to be open in the first place about what it's making you feel, your response to it, and it does come out in the episode, and his response is entirely, like, awful, and just, like, it makes it feel like a competition. And I was like, dude, Summer resigned herself to the fact that, like, she was just going to, you know, stay in California and all of this. Like, she now has something more for herself.
Yes.
But the fact that, like, now we're just like, oh, Summer's a genius. Like, Summer's the full package now. Look over here. I don't know if you've started to notice this, but I think we talked about it in a recent previous episode, but, like, this whole thing where you can see the seeds planting because maybe they've now figured that Marissa's going to die, right?
Yeah, they're like trying to get the next place in this very bizarre version of a storytelling option mm-hmm. that they've created. Like, yeah. So this is the weird thing, is that I almost wish that I had been doing the star rating thing since the beginning, because I feel like my stars don't reflect the quality of this season at all. This was actually an episode that I ended up being like, yeah, you know what? This was like a harmless, easy watch, 3 stars. But I don't know if it's getting 3 stars because I am I'm enjoying these episodes, or I've just accepted that this show is bad and I'm not being as invested. So, like, as long as no one's getting hit by a car or gunshots are going off, I'm just like, oh, what an easy breezy episode of the OC.
Yeah,
like there was no large screaming fight that happened in this episode, so my anxiety wasn't through the roof. So it's a 5 out of 5, perfect episode, because I've just been beaten down by all of the episodes before it. Let's pause on the Summer and Seth thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to very quickly talk about the Kirsten Julie subplot in this episode, where they're trying to come up with their business idea.
The useless subplot. We didn't need a C story.
This is a D story, Joe. There are 4 plots.
What?
Happening.
This is a D story?
Yeah, think about it, because you've got the A story is Johnny Marissa. The B story is Ryan, Matt, and Sandy strip club. The C story,
yes,
Seth and Summer. And then the D story is the 5 minutes we get of Julie and Kirsten trying to come up with what their business is going to be. And, like, Kirsten opens it up with a pretty easy idea. Hey, we should open up a bookstore. There's no bookstore at Newport Beach. To which Julie throws down her idea of nude maids, which, like, chaos. Then we get this dumb concept of they're like, oh, we're going to be caterers or whatever. Like, Kirsten's gone from the person whose biggest culinary experience is ordering out really well, is now so good at cooking post-rehab that they can open a catering company. And this guy's like, hey, I've got a private event happening, $5,000 for you two to cater it. And then they show up and no one's there, and he's pulling some creepy bullshit of, like, I'm still going to pay you $5,000, but I just want a night alone with Julie Cooper. To which she's like, yeah, I wasn't interested. Like, she goes on the date, and then afterwards, there's nothing to talk about. And that's when Kirsten, it's insane that Kirsten's the one that pitches this, is like, we can run a high-end dating service. That's called prostitution, Kirsten. And if this subplot doesn't end with her getting arrested for prostitution or soliciting, I don't know what will, because you can't charge people $5,000 for a date and people not to expect that sex is somewhere on the ticket that they're paying
for.
Well,
you can. In the state of California, I believe you can do that in the sense that, like, what the thing that you have paid them for is their time. Mm-hmm. And then whatever happens, happens between them. I mean, like, that's the, it, this is the gray area, right? Like,
yeah.
Lawyer stripper would tell you that this is the kind of advice lawyer stripper gives you.
You know what? That's the spinoff that I would have watched the shit out of. If, like, when the OC went away, they're like, you know, because the spinoffs are never on, like, one of the main cast members. It's like this character that showed up for one episode. And it's like, I wonder what their life's like. I would watch Lawyer Stripper, like lawyer by day, stripper by night, solving most of her cases through conversations with her regulars. Like, Joe, let's get on it. We could sell this. We could sell this to CBS right now.
It would
right
be
now.
Like Lawyer Stripper, Matt, and then Chili, right? Like Chili's mm-hmm. the intern.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
lawyer
you got to find
stripper,
like
she's still having to strip a little bit, but... You know, we're keeping it secret from the rest of the firm.
Yeah, but now she's not doing it for the money. She's doing it for the kicks. She just enjoys it. Like, mm-hmm. and there ain't nothing wrong with that. That's what I want to stress. But yeah, that the Julie Kirsten subplot, worthless. Now let's get into what is like the real meat and potatoes of this episode, which is the Johnny and Marissa thing. And like, here's my biggest thing that I took away from this is, like, I still think Johnny is a solid dude, right? Like, Johnny, okay. First of all, I love that Johnny's kind of ashamed of his normal human house because all these people live in fucking mansions.
Yeah.
But I love him pulling Summer to the side and is essentially just like, you need to get Marissa to stop helping me because I know that I have feelings for her. And I don't want those to blossom into something else. I don't want to say anything that will get any of us in trouble. Like, it is actually a very respectful, because we've all, I think that every one of us at some point in our lives has gotten a crush on a friend's partner in some way, shape, or form. And we just mm-hmm. know, all right, I need to like pull myself away a little bit, or I need to work internally on what these feelings mean, but I am certainly not going to put these into action at all. And he is trying his absolute best to be a good, respectable person about these emotions, because not only does he like Marissa, he likes Ryan. Like, he mm-hmm. doesn't want to hurt Ryan in that way either. So
yeah,
I love that. I feel like the show, through the music cue, really tries to make Marissa and Johnny falling asleep on the couch together seem so much more intimate than it mm-hmm. actually is. Because, like, again, who among us has not fallen asleep next to a friend while watching something on the couch? Like,
yeah.
And it'd be, like, not sexual in the slightest. It's just like, oh, my God, I want to finish this movie, or I want to finish what we're watching, or my ride isn't here. With Marissa, it's Ryan's fault. Ryan doesn't show up.
Yeah.
Because he's stuck at a strip club. But then I also wrote down, and maybe this is me looking at the privilege of all of these other characters, Marissa, Summer, nor the Coens, none of them can pony up some money to give Johnny a live-in nurse or something to help him out. It has to just be Marissa there before yeah. and after school every
it
day.
It always has to be Marissa.
Yeah. It's like, so, like, that was getting me so annoyed, because I'm like, you guys have so much money that you throw away at so much stupid shit, and just paying for like someone to show up when his mom's at work for a couple hours would be nothing. Like, it would be pennies to the dollar in comparison True. To what you spend on like a daily trip to yeah. some nonsense place. Then I wrote down this line that I laughed at so hard when I thought of it. So Johnny slips and falls and retwists his ankle. Mm-hmm. And Marissa gives him some drugs. And I guess she gave him a little too much, because he's a little bit looser with his thoughts and his feelings. And he says, "You're making this hard." And she says, "Making what hard?" And I wrote, "My dick." But which I was like, please say it. Please say it, Johnny, do it.
Yeah. My dick.
But yeah, he admits that he has feelings for her, and I like that he's like, I don't want you to tell me anything. I'm just saying it. That's it. And then I actually think the ending of this episode, similarly to how I talked about the ending of the episode where Ryan beats the shit out of a punching bag, is like their relationship has never been healthier than them having this phone conversation where Ryan is freely mentioning that he was stuck at a strip club and she's not freaking out about it. And she's telling him what happened with Johnny and he's not freaking out about it. Like it is the most normal, trusting, respectable, open relationship that they've open to each other relationship that they've had this entire show, honestly. Because could you imagine season one, how Ryan would react if one of Marissa's friends from school had told her he had feelings for her, or vice versa, if Ryan had told Marissa that he spent a night in a strip club? Like, it would have been immediate fireworks, and then we'd have like a 5-part episode of them trying to get back together after the breakup blow up. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I actually think that their relationship has matured quite a bit. Now, for how long, who knows? I mean, this doesn't mean that neither one of these things won't be pulled out of someone's back pocket later on in an episode as ammo. But the only thing I missed was that there is a very funny runner in this episode where anytime that it's brought up how smart Summer is, the pinnacle of her intelligence is, well, she did save Chris McCall, which is both funny and preparing the audience for next week's episode, which is, of course, the third Chris McCall episode.
It is mind-blowing.
And heartbreaking.
How many original scripts are written every year but are never made.
So we seek out these scripts and bring them to life with full audio production and professional actors.
Check us out at Undiscovered Scripts.
Movies made of paper.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Free!
91 Donkey Lane is a magical apartment complex that contains immense power but lacks intelligent inhabitants.
What is happening?
I'm getting texts.
Why are we getting a lot of texts?
People found out what we did.
Oh, dividing Mike Myers into an infinite amount of tiny Mike Myers?
Listen to 91 Donkey Lane for free on Spotify or your favorite podcasting app. More at 91donkeylane.com. See you there, you donkeys.
So, Joe, did you hate this? Is this one of your least favorite episodes? Like I said, I throw this a generous
no.
3 stars for it not stressing me out, but it's kind of a dog shit episode.
No, it's dog shit. It has too many plots. It's where we're starting to like pivot the characters' motivations about shit. Like I at the risk of revealing something in season 4, a couple episodes ago, something happened where I was like, oh, that's where this concept is introduced, because then it becomes a much bigger deal in season 4.
Gotcha.
But again, it's like the little crumbs that whether or not they, I'm curious if at this point they knew that Marissa wasn't going to come back.
Yeah. It's interesting. And that's like one of those things where I guess they'll never say when was the exact moment they knew and started making decisions. Mm-hmm. But it definitely feels like, as we've said, the last couple episodes, they already know that it's like a 50-50 chance.
Yeah.
Just based on everything that's happening. They're like, she might not come back. So we gotta have a plan in place if that ends up being the case.
Yeah.
But, you know, all in all, I still think that season 3 is the worst, but I don't think that this episode is the worst. This isn't even the worst episode in season 3 so far. Like, this is such a middle of the ground, like middle of the pack, forgettable episode. I can't say I'll never forget about this episode, because like I said, I was screaming at my television when she said they're my clients. Like, that was, I was like, what is happening? But you know what, Joe? Sometimes these mediocre episodes also have the most extensive musical soundtracks.
And boy, did they spend money. I mean, they were in a strip club, right?
So there's like 5 strip club songs at least. But so we get the 88s with Hard to Be You as the opening song, a group called Fine China with their song My Worst Nightmare plays when Summer and Seth are talking about college prospects. When Matt and Ryan enter the strip club, Clients Come On is playing. Billy Squire's The Stroke is playing when Ryan gets his lap dance. Mm-hmm. Invisible Man's Make It Bounce plays as Ryan calls Marissa, but she already fell asleep. Nikki Costa's On and On plays when Sandy finds Matt at the strip club. And the Shout Out Loud's Go Sadness plays at the end of the episode. Joe, I feel like you're exactly like me. The second The Stroke played, you're like, well, this is it. Like, this is the song of the episode.
Also, like, I've seen it a couple times with, like, stripper montages to have The Stroke in it, and it doesn't make sense to me. Like, I don't, like, The Stroke is so, like, on the nose for, yeah. on the nose camp for, like, a stripper song, right?
You realize Crazy Bitch right now is the number one like strip club song. Like everything's about on the nose if you're in a strip club, I imagine.
Wait, Crazy Bitch? What song?
Crazy Bitch by Buckcherry. Hey, y'all crazy bitch, but you fuck so good I'm on top of it when I scream. Have you never heard the song Crazy Bitch?
No, what is this?
Oh, this was like a top radio rock song in like the 2010s. It's literally when you hear a song and you go, well, that song was written to be part of a strip club. Like it is the most this song was written to be a strip club song you've ever heard. I wanted to give a weird shout out because the group Fine China, I recognized the name and I was like, I think I know why I know this name. They were a former Tooth and Nail Records band, which was like the top Christian punk record label of the 2000s. So I don't know if they still... So Tooth and Nail's kind of weird in the sense that the owner of the label was religious, didn't want to run a religious label, but would sign a lot of religious bands and thus became known as a religious label. So there's definitely a handful of bands that have absolutely no religious ties whatsoever who just happen to like do a couple albums on there. And it's kind of hard to tell them apart because one of his... only rules was like don't curse on your albums on my label basically. So I don't know what the story is with Fine China, but their Wikipedia just calls them an alternative rock band. So I'm gonna say that even if they were, they aren't anymore. And you know, Tooth and Nail Records was a huge part of my pop culture history, and the OC was a huge part of a lot of other people's pop culture history. So I think it's time for us to talk about some of the pop culture stuff that we've been popping into over the last couple weeks. And I've got a very quick one. I read a delightful graphic novel that had won a couple, I think it won like a few awards. I can't remember off the top of my head now what any of them were, but it's one of those books where it even has like the little seal in the corner saying like this is an award-winning book called El Defo by C.C. Bell. And it's written by an actual deaf woman about her experiences being deaf in the 50s as a little girl. And it's pretty interesting. All of the characters are rabbits, which she said was intentional because she's like, rabbits are known for their great hearing. So I thought that a rabbit who was deaf just made it extra sad and ironic and traumatic. And it just is about this little girl trying to make friends who like her for who she is. And it's very sugary sweet. And I mean, I knocked out the whole, it's probably like a 300 page graphic novel. I knocked it out in two nights, just cause I couldn't put it down. I was so enticed to see what happens next with the character and, you know, that hopefulness of like, I hope this all turns out all right. Like you assume it will, but you never, there's no guarantees in life. That's my big recommend. But how about you, Joe? What have you been diving into?
For whatever reason, I'm like revisiting a lot of like formative gay film television. Like I just feel, I don't know what it is about the cold and the winter, but it's making me, you know, ruminate a little bit on the culture that made me say queerness was for me. And so the one I want to talk about right now is Looking, which was on, at the time, was on HBO. It was an HBO original series. I saw this article that GQ released recently. Was it GQ? It was one of the gay magazines that GQ, that they picked up a GQ story. But essentially, it was like, you know, 10 years of the cult classic Looking. And Looking was a show that basically wanted to do for gay men in San Francisco what girls did for girls living in New York City. It's about a very tight-knit group of friends living in San Francisco. This came out in 2014. And the article goes on to talk about, like, you know, the staying power of a show that only did two seasons. And then they closed everything. Once they were canceled, they did put a cap on everything with, like, a 90-minute movie.
Okay.
And it was just, like, it's so interesting because, like, I am like at that time in my life, and again, this is related to this show, to the show that we're doing right now. Like at the time in my life in 2014, like I had no, like I really didn't have queer friends except for Joshua, and like I was still kind of yearning for some, for like deeper queer community. And even then, like Joshua and I weren't as close as we are now. Like we were just, I was just starting to get into podcasting. We hadn't even talked about it yet. But we weren't as close as we were now. And I didn't have really many, like, if any, like, gay friends. And so seeing Looking was just like this aspirational wish fulfillment show of just like gay people living their gay lives and doing the gay things. And I just remember thinking like, wow, I really resonate with this.
Yeah.
10 years later, looking back on it now, and the, you know, I work for a queer nonprofit. Like my life is very gay, save for like you, Matt, and a couple of other straight people. But it's so interesting to like see. I haven't watched the show. I feel like I haven't. I feel like maybe I watched it in like COVID time, but like didn't really pay attention. And now that I'm like really paying attention, I'm in this like space of. January is always a very reflective time. And so feeling because of that, looking at the show, I just feel like, wow, there's so much that still is good, like still resonates in things that like I've taken unknowingly and learned from the show that has like helped me inform me like how I've lived over the last few years, the last decade. But in other ways, like it's also cringe and just like seeing how, oh, I identified with the main character so much, but he's like so needy. He's so cringe and needy. And I'm like, oh, no, where did that come from? So it's just been nice to like have those moments where like, oh, this. And then I'm doing this bit. I have a group chat with some gay friends where every time I see like an actor that's like has like a bit part in the show. But they're like now kind of a sort of famous gay actor, or like, you know, maybe like a C-list, D-list gay actor. I just text the name of them. I just text the name to people because I'm like, there's actually a lot of them. And this show did a really good job of trying to hire as many queer actors as possible. It's so good. Scott Bakula's in it as like this 60-year-old daddy. I'm trying to make Matt love it.
I'm sure I'll check. Listen, I will check out damn near anything. I've just set up the impossible task of trying to watch all 40-something seasons of Survivor, and I'm still only on season 2. So my backlog is all backed up right now with junk. But I'll make sure that's something I check out. That sounds like something I would probably enjoy, and it's only 2 seasons. So like,
it's only 2 seasons and a 90-minute movie, and each episode is 30 minutes. So
yeah, see, that's
it's really
it's
good.
A little.
If you do check out Looking, please let me know. And like, I would love you. I mean, maybe that
you
season
would be the first person you'd hear from. What did you think in that season 6 or 5 or 6 of White People Problems?
I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of white people, and they got a lot of problems. There's white people in the show, and they got a lot of problems. In fact, I was commenting it with a friend who was living in San Francisco around the time that Looking was being filmed there, and he was like, "It's so weird that like there are no gay Asian male characters in a show that takes place in San Francisco."
Yeah,
at that time, listen. And I was like, "Yeah, because racism, and you know."
Well, that's why we do this damn show, right? Because white people mm-hmm. problems matter just as much as everybody else.
Yeah.
And when are there going to be storytellers telling our story my story as a white person with problems? Stay tuned.
Don't end on that.
I'm obviously joking. But what I'm not joking about is next week when we come back for more white people problems.
It is mind-blowing.
And heartbreaking.
How many original scripts are written every year but are never made.
So we seek out these scripts and bring them to life with full audio production and professional actors.
Check us out at Undiscover Scripts.
Movies made of paper.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Free!
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.